Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover...
Inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God, this is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, something new for you today on the Rest is History feed, because we're giving you a chance to try out our new podcast, our sister podcast, called The Rest is Politics. Catchy title. It's hosted by Alistair Campbell, who used to be the spin doctor for Tom Holland's hero, Tony Blair, and the former Conservative MP and Cabinet Minister, Roy Stewart, who used to be at university with me. And they're going to be getting into current events and politics from Britain and across the world. Now, obviously, as you might imagine, the first episode is dominated by Ukraine, with insights from having actually met and dealt with Vladimir Putin when he was still welcome in the capitals of the West. You can find a link to the full episode in the show notes, or just search for The Rest is Politics. Wherever you listen to us, the rest is history. Enjoy.
Hello, I'm Rory Stewart.
And I'm Alistair Campbell.
Welcome to our new podcast, The Rest is Politics. Look, Alistair, we had grand plans for what we want to talk about. We were going to, I think, talk about our different backgrounds, our different political interests. We were going to talk about mental health. I was going to talk about Afghanistan. But we just suddenly found ourselves, I think, facing this insane situation in Ukraine. Probably the biggest single thing since the Second World War in terms of European war.
I know, and it's just incredibly depressing. I'm sure I'm not alone in finding it very, 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 very hard to sleep at the moment. And I know we'll have lots of time, hopefully. Hopefully this is the first of many, and we'll cover all sorts of stuff on this podcast. But frankly, there is only one place to start. We're recording this on the morning, Tuesday the 1st of March. So how do we start talking about Ukraine?
I think the first thing is just the scale of it. It's almost unimaginable that for the first time since the Second World War, we're seeing an invasion of this scale taking place in Europe. And it undoes so many of the assumptions that people had since 1989, since the end of the Cold War. I mean, I remember when I was chair of the Defense Committee and I was trying to argue for why we wanted to keep some troops in Europe and tanks in Europe and heavy bridging capacity. Essentially, people laughed at it and were saying, actually, even quite recently, that the days of wars, land wars in Europe, were over.
I think part of the problem is that Putin has been planning this kind of thing and building up to this kind of thing for some time. And at the moment, when you think about where it goes, he either retreats in humiliation, and I think the chances of that are negligible, or he just keeps going and going and going and going. And I think part of Putin's modus operandi, particularly in the kind of the second half of his rule, I think it's been interesting to watch him develop. But he doesn't stop, and we saw that in, you know, he's still in Syria. He exploits weakness wherever he sees it, and I think at the moment he's seen an awful lot of weakness and he's exploiting it. So it's very, very hard to work out where it goes.
There is one big thing we can do which will make a huge difference. But I mean, I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about Putin. But quickly, I think the one big thing is oil and gas. I think that is so central to the Russian economy. And it's going to be very costly for Germany and Italy, 40% of their gas more than 40% in Italy's case to cut that off, and it'll have an impact on the European global economy. But it can totally be done. There are alternative sources. People can convert to oil. They can bring in liquid natural gas from Qatar, from the US. We need to do that immediately. That is the one thing that Putin assumes will not be done. And that's the one thing that will have a huge impact. But tell us, Elsa, you've actually met the guy, which I haven't. What is your sense of Putin as a man?
Well, I saw him in various phases. Tony Blair first met Putin before he became president. And I remember the Foreign Office being a little bit worried that we shouldn't be seeing him before he became president, but everybody knew that he was going to be president. And it was a little bit sort of, you know, trying to get ahead of the game in a way. And it's funny, I was looking at some of the news footage that they were playing on the BBC the other night. He looks completely different today to how he did then. And it's not just age, because actually he has de-aged with all his Botox and his plastic surgery and all the rest of it. But he looked very, almost timid, very slight, very small, very quite quiet. And I think at that stage had decided that he was going to, if you like, look more favourably towards the West than historically maybe people like him have done. And I think then the next phase was where he started to perhaps understand how difficult reform was in Russia, but also I think he started to feel his power. And I can remember, I think it was 2003, and I left Downing Street in 2003. So that was probably the last time I saw him face to face. He was a completely different animal already. He phoned the Russians, got in touch with number 10. They invited Tony Blair out. It was literally like a day trip. And we thought this might be a bridge building exercise. And we got there and we landed and we got flown to some place in the middle of nowhere, which is his vast dacha with swimming pools and stallions and butlers and all the sort of stuff you associate with, you know, newfound oligarchical wealth. And he proceeded to, that humiliates the wrong word, because Tony doesn't sort of lend himself to humiliation, but just to abuse him and to shout and to, he was really, really raging about the Americans in every single aspect of foreign policy. And basically he didn't say Bush's poodle, but it wasn't far off.
And was he doing this on camera, or he was just doing this privately?
No, what happened was we got there, had a meeting. Then there was a very short sort of press conference, and he really laid in. I'll never forget, Trevor Kavanagh of The Sun was there. And I'll never forget the look on Trevor Kavanagh's face. He sort of, I think they'd gone there thinking this was just a sort of, you know, going to be a non-event day trip. And he suddenly realised, oops, there's quite a big story here. And then we went into dinner, and it was at the dinner that he really, really started to lay in. And I remember coming out, David Manning, who was our main foreign affairs advisor, and he said, I've never, ever, ever seen anything like that. And I said, that's sort of the death of diplomacy. He said, exactly. Anyway, so that's 2003. We're almost two decades on. So if that was the change between 1999 and 2003, why should we think that he hasn't changed in many, many, many ways since?
It's bizarre watching him too, isn't it? Because as you say, his face has that very, very odd shape that you get from kind of billionaires who are using weird sort of, I don't know what they use, some unspeakable sort of treatment on their features. And it's and as you say, this insane table, his extreme COVID regulations, the sense in the last televised event that the head of his foreign intelligence service looks completely sort of paralyzed and terrified when Putin's talking. The invasion of Crimea, it was said in 2014, was an all-night event where he was consulting with these people, trying to convince them. This time it seems as though he didn't consult at all. And that's actually what's made the really impressive achievement of American intelligence, because really they called the whole thing. I mean, it's the one big success. In fact, actually, people sometimes ask what the use of intelligence is, but here, because the CIA basically found the entire invasion plan and then decided to go public with it 3 weeks ago and said, this guy's going to invade on this date, completely destroyed Putin's attempt to pretend it was a spontaneous reaction to, you know, genocide in Ukraine or some provocation to Ukraine, and actually gave the West 3 weeks to build up, and also gave 3 weeks to a lot of people to embarrass themselves, saying, don't worry, he's never going to invade. The Americans are crying wolf. This is ridiculous. including actually, you know, the ex-head of the British intelligence service saying, if anybody thinks this guy is going to roll into Kiev and try to occupy Ukraine, of course that's not going to happen. So I think it's been interesting that it's probably the biggest intelligence success in the last 25 years.
Yeah, it's very hard to define it in those terms when you see what's actually happening now. It's all very well to know something's going to happen. It's what you do to prevent it.
Yeah.
And what you do when it happens. And I think that's where at the moment we look a little bit, as you indicated earlier, like we're catching up after the event and we're, you do have a sense of, you know, we all feel powerless, but even the people in power, I think, are feeling quite powerless.
And there's a lot of bluff, isn't there? There's a lot of people, you know, saying we're sending X amount of money, and it turns out to be, you know, we're sending 80 million at the same time when yesterday, I believe, Europe transferred 300 million to Russia to pay for oil and gas. Mm. So the kind of gap between what we claim we're doing and what we're actually doing is still very extreme.
But what do you do? You talked about bluff. What when you have a situation where he denies he's going to invade, but everybody knows that he is. And as you say, the Americans kind of got it almost hour by hour. I did feel a little bit worried that the default position of most of the Western leaders as that was happening was essentially to say to their own public opinion, don't worry, we will not be fighting him in Ukraine. Now, I completely understand why, okay? But if you're sitting there as Putin and your entire strategy is founded upon strength, are you not seeing weakness that you think?
So that was the first 10 minutes or so of our new podcast, The Rest is Politics, with me, Rory Stewart, and Alistair Campbell. We hope you enjoyed it. Later in the episode, we get into the question of the most effective response from NATO, Russian money, and influence in Western politics, and we even find time to squeeze in an extraordinary anecdote about Bono and Bob Geldof berating Tony Blair. To listen to it, you can find the link in the episode description or just search The Rest is Politics, wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening again.
Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.